Vacant Expressions, 1 hour of your life you will not get back. We are your hosts. I'm Wesley Fox. With me, as always, is my brother, John Fox. Ed, some things have changed since the last recording. It's been about probably 2 months, 2.5 months. I've moved out of North Carolina to Kirkland, Washington. So the time zones are different. Arranging this is all different. But we're back. Everything's unpacked. Everything's ready to go. So, yeah, John, how you doing?
I'm doing good. So, I mean, the only difference, you know, for your move is now you're going to pretend to like their shitty local beers.
Yes, exactly. And hopefully get some sponsorships out of them, because I didn't get any out of North Carolina. Cheap bastards. But, yeah, what are you drinking?
So tonight I tried something new. I like Malbecs a lot, and it's hard to find a good variety on them because I think it's one of the ones where they still I guess they're still mostly technically from that region. So, you know, they don't always have every vineyard doesn't always have their own Malbec like they do a Merlot or, you know, other such wine. But it's by Red Diamond. It's a 2012. And, you know, it's pretty much everything I want in a Malbec. It's not ridiculously great, but it's just like a great middle-of-the-road red. It's, you know, sweet and dry, and I'm definitely still enjoying it. I feel like Malbec's one of those ones where it doesn't have to be a great wine, and you're still going to get, like, roughly what you want out of it.
I see. I'm not a big fan. I haven't tried a lot of Malbecs, but the ones I have, I haven't enjoyed that much. But I definitely, that's on my list of wines where I want to explore a little more and see if maybe I've just been drinking the wrong ones. I've just moved here, and the wine store is kind of a drive away, so I decided just to go to the grocery store and get beer. And so I just got Fat Tire, New Belgium.
All right, can't go wrong.
Yeah, this is my favorite beer. I don't know anything about Washington beers yet, so I had to go with an old trusty.
So you're in a good situation there because you're moving to good beer country up there, like Oregon and Washington. I think a little bit more so Oregon than Washington, but still, like, there's a huge craft brew industry out there, and that's been thriving for a really long time, and it's kind of like the Colorado market where they were doing it a little bit before it was cool. And so you got a lot of good heritage and craft brews, I believe, out there, as well as probably a bit of the boom that we're all experiencing is still very prevalent there.
Yeah, I am in Kirkland, which is right outside Seattle, like right across the lake. And like the reputation here is that it's like all hipster and, you know, everything is about craft and everything. And so far, my experience, I've only been here a week, but my experience has bared that out. They have a ton of microbrews at the nearby bars. They also have a ton of wine. Washington is a growing wine country. It makes a lot of like the stuff you'll find in grocery stores across the country, Chateau St. Michel. That is their main tasting winery is 20 minutes away from my apartment. In a small town called Woodinville, which is like two towns over, but it's like a 20-minute drive. And apparently, all of the other major vineyards and companies in this area, and they're mostly larger. There's plenty of small family operations, but there's a lot of big ones that are more of like quantity and are just popular across the country, but they're not really known for making, you know, high-end, you know, $100 bottles of wine. But they all have, like, taste wineries and tastings and all these events in Woodinville, which is 20 minutes away. And I've been told that the Chateau St. Michel winery has concerts, and they just had one with Sheryl Crow. I think it was last week. Yeah.
I mean, not that I'm a huge Sheryl Crow fan, but, I mean, but who's not a little bit of a fan?
She's kind of – I mean, well, it gives you an idea of what kind of you know, what kind of juice they have.
Yeah, I mean, that's A-list star power, you know, like people still buy her records, you know, because she has the type of fans that don't know how to download for free.
Exactly. Yeah. They all pay for it.
But, yeah, she's making money.
Oh yeah. I don't worry about Sheryl Crow. I mean,
that's really cool though. That's really cool. I mean, no, but I mean that they have events like that. Like, I mean, we got a botanic garden just like two blocks down, and it's really tight that they have events there. But just a few years ago, they had BB King playing. Didn't know even realize he was still alive and playing. And it's just nice. Right there at the at the Botanic Gardens. They're little, small, intimate shows. They only fit a couple hundred people, which is even cooler. But we're close enough that we could hear it from, you know, if we open up our windows and stuff and it's not a windy day.
That is awesome. I mean, you and I have both done, like, the really big venues, you know, that are, you know, 20, 30,000, 40,000 people. They're loud. Or we've done stadiums before. But, like, because we're both getting older, like, I do definitely, I'm starting to appreciate a smaller venues, like, of maybe 1,000 or maybe a few hundred. And, I mean, Chateau Saint-Michel, I believe, is, like, that kind of a size venue. And there's also a few venues in downtown Seattle, which are kind of smaller, almost like House of Blues kind of size.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a small venue, but it's not an arena. So it's kind of like a, I don't know, mid-size maybe is not the right word, but like, you know. So I'm looking forward to that. Obviously, from what I'm told, this is all reputation. This place has like a big indie rock music scene. Of course, it's known for the grunge movement in the early 90s. Heavy metal seems to be kind of big here, judging by how many like people wearing black band shirts I've seen.
And, well, have you tuned through the radio stations yet?
No, that was actually one of my homework assignments for the weekend. I was going to go online and look for all the awesome radio shows and program them into my car because my car finally showed up on Wednesday. And, of course, all the presets are to North Carolina stations, so they're worthless. I need to like start from scratch and reprogram my radio. So that's definitely one of the things on my to-do list for the weekend. This is my first weekend where I don't have to unpack, so now I can do some like more advanced moving in projects like that.
Well, I'm excited that you're almost settled in, and I can't wait to visit you out there. I've never been to Seattle or the area, so it'll be fun.
I've had a small dose of it so far, so not much, but I think you would love it. I think everyone would love it. It is an amazing
If you've already had a small dose of Seattle, you probably will not pass a pee test.
Yeah. You know what? I was wondering if my drug test came out okay. And it was actually like I had to take that 2 weeks after I visited you in Denver. So I was kind of worried that I might, you know, if they were testing for marijuana, maybe, you know, I might fail it because of that. But either that or they don't test for it because this is Washington. It's legal
here. Yeah. Yeah, they might just take it off the list. Wait, did we smoke? We didn't smoke. Did we smoke?
No, I was worried about a contact high or something like that. Because I was around it a lot. Like, I didn't smoke, but...
I was going to say, I should have remembered that. Like,
Marijuana affects the memory. But, no, it's... And I've already smelled it. Like, I know at least one of my neighbors smokes, which, I mean, I'm cool with. I think it smells fine. I haven't partaken in a long time, but I'm totally cool with the smell and... It kind of takes me back to the good old days when I used to be completely irresponsible. Now I'm only partially irresponsible. But
adulting's a bitch.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, it's a new city. You and I have both lived in a bunch of places. We've been in, like, part of the old Midwest, the Rust Belt, Chicago, the suburbs there, places, you know, that have been around for a few decades. We both spent some time in Raleigh. I spent some more time than you. And then you went to Denver, which is kind of considered a newer city, even though it's pretty big and been around. But, like, it's a lot of construction. It's considered a modern city, and Seattle is too. So I figured for our first inaugural show in my new location, we might talk about the cities of the future. So... That is what we're going to go with today, and to kind of help people along here instead of us just talking, I figured I'm going to put a few links in the show notes so that you can kind of follow along. But basically, I found a couple sites where they lay out ideas for the cities of the future, like concept art, futurist art, and I mean, some of this stuff looks like it's straight out of science fiction, which is awesome, but some of it is actually somewhat close to reality within the next 10 to 15 years. So, yeah, I figured maybe we do that today in addition to, I don't know, whatever else we feel like talking about. We tend to stay away from the news, which I continue to hold to that policy. Yeah. And it's a little bit of a slow lull in the movie arena, in TV arena. It's the summer, so I don't know. I figured we'd do that for that show for today, and I don't know, whatever else comes up.
Absolutely. And that was a fine segue, by the way. Fine segue. You know.
Thank you. I'm
moving to a new city. City's the future. Bravo. Bravo.
I gave it a shot, and I'm going to take some classes on Segways. I think that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
While riding a Segway.
So. That's the only way to learn. So, I'm going to go off of just this first one right here, and it seems ridiculous to a lot of people, and it did to me at first, the floating city. And, why isn't that ridiculous? First, you think it's ridiculous because, of course, it's going to sink. The Titanic sunk. All of these things still sink. Everything is eventually going to sink. Why would you just put all your eggs in one basket and have your whole city freaking sink? Why is this potentially feasible in our lifetime? That's what I still wonder about. And when I go through and see all the awesome systems involved in it and the way they could recycle stuff and energy and this and that, like, I get it, but how is it sink-proof? And that's what I'm always concerned.
My first concern when I saw these seasteading institutes, and there's whole books written about this, and there's one that's supposedly going to launch in, like, 2020 or 2021, and it's going to be like its own micro nation. It's not going to be part of any country. But they say, like, they, like, the thing I was worried about is, like, what about, like, hurricanes and cyclones? Like, are you going to be able to evade those? Like, can you move the city?
So essentially, yeah, they'll be able to move. And also, once you reach a certain size, like, waves don't get bigger than a certain size. And there are, like, rogue waves that can maybe get 100 feet in the middle of the ocean. But if you're even compensating for rogue waves like that, you could build a structure that could go past them. Just like, an oil tanker or a cruise liner, they're longer than waves are crest to crest. But if they get hit sideways by a wave, they could obviously be taken out. So they have their limitations, but part of the reason their size makes them safer. So presumably the larger the city is, the bigger the size is, the safer it's going to be. So I see that potentially engineering around that type of stuff. But there's always going to be that next storm that it's like, can it be in like the center of a hurricane? Can a hurricane go directly over it? Or is it always just going to have to rely on being able to evade it as well? Will they build it to that standard? Because I feel like even with earthquakes, it's like, oh, yeah, this whole city's built to withstand up to a 7 or an 8-point earthquake. Well, yeah, but there's been a 9 before, so what happens then? We know it's possible. Like, well, then the entire city will be destroyed. So, but,
they don't have to worry about tsunamis because those occur near shores. They don't occur out in the ocean. So that's one thing that they don't have to worry about. They don't have to worry about volcanoes because if there's any active volcanoes, they can just float away. Mm-hmm. If they have enough mobility, they can evade storms. I don't know how, like, mobile these places are. But you're absolutely right, too. Like, if you built it to a certain size, it doesn't matter how big the wave is. If you're big enough, the wave will hit you. You'll feel it, but it's not gonna sink anything.
Yeah, and you're not gonna ride that whole wave. The wave's gonna kind of go past you, And as long as people kind of have a sheltered area, I'm sure the open areas are not going to be safe during extreme storms, but they're obviously going to be able to contain on the inside. And then, like, under the water, it's a lot more stable, So, and also presumably, just like with any ship, there's a good portion of this that is under the water and on the surface, or, below the surface. So,
okay.
That's always probably a good place to go, but then going back to it, what is the ironclad way to keep it afloat? I mean, is it just using things like, like material that like won't absorb water but it's lighter than water, so there's nothing to ever like break or leak? Like is it something like that, like a foam type material, so it's not like you can't break the hull and then it leaks and takes on water and then it sinks? Like it's so buoyant and the parts that make it buoyant are unsinkable.
I think it has I haven't read the book yet. There's a few books out. I've one of them's on my to read list, but I haven't gotten to it. I think they do kind of the waterproof bulkhead kind of concept where every part of the city has its own ballast tanks to keep it afloat. And if one breaks, the rest of them aren't affected because they're all kind of compartmentalized. So it's kind of like in a submarine where you shut the hatch on the flooding part of the ship and the rest of the submarine's okay, but that part is gone.
I guess you're right. And if you have enough of them and there's a problem in one, they could evacuate in the other. They're never completely filled to capacity. They're probably not going to have a whole half of it damaged at once unless it's actually attacked, but like intentionally. And I'm even seeing like the image of this one, if you guys are following along, for the very first image, you even see a border around it. So even like the shores within, you know, the network of buildings and structures that are floating, there's still like a ring harbor around it, so they don't get huge waves. So it's like a quiet harbor on the inside.
That's absolutely necessary, because these are basically going to be like floating port cities is what I think it's supposed to be. That the way they are connected to the – because they're not going to be like isolated from the world. They are going to be interconnected, but they – I think the idea they have behind it is they want to build like this libertarian micronation that is open like
– No, no,
not,
what I –
doesn't have any kind of like the hang-ups about being part of a big country or an advanced country. It's a micronation of maybe a few thousand, 10,000, 20,000 people, but they make arrangements with, you know, Japan, United States, Canada, whatever.
Essentially, they're going to find their way around awesome international trade laws and international laws. It's like taking a boat out into international waters and no laws apply. I love it. It's going to be a rich pirate nation.
That is what they want. I mean, there's already micronations around that are very wealthy. I mean, there's plenty of Pacific Isles. Their populations are maybe a few hundred thousand, 50,000. I mean, Iceland has less than 1 million people, and they're an advanced country. That island's a pretty good size, but, like, the population's not that big.
I think a lot of it has to do with international banking as well as, like, fishing.
The harbor's key. You have to have a harbor. And the only way you can have a harbor is when you have those breakers. And you see in the picture here, that circular breaker it has.
I meant the physical harbor, so all the water on the inside isn't choppy, even if it's like the outside waves are open. Like if they were in the North Atlantic or the North Pacific, those are just choppy-ass fucking water. But inside the borders of the city, it could still be fairly calm.
Yeah, and the only way a nation, a floating city, could really survive is if it had developed, you know, the relations with other countries to import what they can't produce. I mean, food being one. They can fish, so it's not like they're completely zero food, but like fish is the only source they would have out there, and they'd have to. I mean, this is a lot of small nations with that, you know, most of us have never heard of that are in the Indian and Pacific and Atlantic oceans. Some of them are pretty wealthy and pretty peaceful. They don't need militaries, and they have, you're right, they have very lax banking laws and finance laws, and that's how they get by, because they have certain advantages to being an isolated island. And I think the Seasteed Institute, I think they want to play on that even more so by creating an artificial island that can move around and create its own, sense of national identity built around being in international waters and not having to worry about all the cultural and political hang-ups that a lot of the advanced countries have these days. And
how ridiculous is that if in our lifetime there's like this floating Atlantis-type place?
Seriously. I mean, you have to – I mean, if it's really successful, you want – everyone's going to want to see it. I'm going to want to see it.
No. And so the tourism will be a huge income generator, let alone any of the banking or any other stuff they might try to produce. But they could do insane, like seawater fish farming and stuff on, like, a really clean level or something. Like, I don't know, just for their own food. But we could get into the guts of it, though. The guts of it, the actual engineering science fiction that's really fun, is the fact that they'd be able to recycle their own water. So they'd have unlimited water. They'd be able to take advantage of tidal energy and different types of way of taking over current energy, as well as solar energy being out there in the open and everything, and being able to move around with that. And so they'd be able to produce their own energy and just be in this complete sustainable place. And they could grow like different types of seaweed and fish and all these other things in this really clean, like, farmed environment that's not like gross factory farming, because you're out in the open, and be able to have this really probably high nutrient, like, really clean diet out there, even though you're isolated, as opposed to being in one of these places that, you know, you have to artificially produce all your own food. Like, you could really do it in such a clean way that would just be for a high standard of living, too. I mean, how awesome is fucking eating seafood all the time?
Yeah, and I would think, well, they may, I mean, I'm sure they have, I don't want to get too far because I think a few of the other cities have this, but the idea of vertical farming or artificial, like, hydroponics. So I don't. It's not like they the only food they would be able to produce is would be sea based. I mean, yeah. They could have farms. They just wouldn't be that big. That's all.
Yeah, but that other. Well, I mean, but that would all just go to to season it and just to have all the other stuff with it. They could obviously produce that. But just having all that bomb seafood all the time. Come on.
I mean, but the lifestyle. Just think of the lifestyle, though. Like you're away from land at all times. You're living on a floating city, so you have to be somebody who really loves the sea, loves the ocean. Like either you're into boats, into surfing, into whatever. Like and being isolated, being in a city in a community that's probably not going to be, when you start off, not going to be much more than a few thousand people, and may not even grow to much beyond a few tens of thousands. Yep. It'd be ambitious. It'd be quite a lifestyle to take on, and to be kind of isolated from the rest of the world. Now, I think given world events, I think that's probably like really appealing right now. Like, I feel like a lot of people in the U.S. are like, you build a floating city in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, I'll meet you there. I have a feeling like that. Like nowadays,
but I mean, obviously it's a certain income bracket that's going to be able to afford it. But there still might be ways around it. There's people that have to support it in the service industry and everything. People that would want to work in one of these places, just like any sort of like high end, cruise line. Yeah, you're even seeing in this image like a cruise ship within the fucking confines of the city. Yeah, like,
I have a feeling like everyone in the city is. I mean, you can bring your own skill set and be an entrepreneur, but I feel like there's a certain amount of work that everyone's going to have to do to make this city stay, like, figuratively and literally afloat.
Yeah.
And, like, I think when you become a citizen, I think there's going to be some demands on you that, look, we want you to do what you want to do with your life, like, on your own time, but there's also a certain, like, basic work that needs to be done to keep this city working, and we're going to have to require everyone to do at least a little bit of it.
And then, like, skills and training and stuff to be able to deal with.
Yeah, that's the kind of work, like, a lot of people are – I mean, a lot of kids are going to get. So instead of working at McDonald's, they might be working in the hydroponics bay or working in the ballast – I don't know, whatever, like, unique utility systems and primary systems that a city like this would need. Some of that work's going to need to be done for this to really function.
And think about this, like preparing the type of logistics and lifestyle and training that people want to take on, like interstellar ships, going throughout space. Like trying to live in these closed communities of hundreds or thousands of people and stuff, and everyone kind of like being in it together and stuff. And then you start realizing, like people doing that on the next level on interstellar ships. So maybe these type of communities are the beginning of at least learning the logistics of that and the socioeconomics of it and the behavioral science around it.
There's also there's that definitely, because you're in an isolated area that's not quite like a spaceship, but still you have to think about you're going to be in a confined area with other people. So
if we ever made large starships, or people that were like large groups of people that were in for long periods of time, it's going to be data based off of this that might be some of the first books that you learn about. When you read about creating these communities and trying to do interstellar travel, they'll probably look back to these projects.
I feel like their immigration system would require like they would look for certain skills, and once you get there, they'll be like, we might have, as part of like citizenship, we'll cross train you in something. Like, for example, in the military, if the medic dies, there's usually another person in the unit that's trained in basic battlefield medicine. So like, you cross train, like you learn the job of your superior, just in case he dies or becomes disabled or she dies or gets shot or is missing, and then you teach your job to somebody beneath you, so that you keep having that. So like when something happens out there, somebody gets injured, it's like, oh shit, our only heart surgeon just drowned. What the hell are we gonna do? You got to be able to adapt and be able to deal with these crises, because you're going to be out there by yourself, separated from, for at least a certain period of time before you can reach Japan, U.S., whatever, and import whatever services or whatever you need.
Hmm.
That's intense.
Absolutely.
I think it would be. I think it'd be a very intense citizenship test, and to live there would be different.
Yeah, it would take a different breed of people, not just the financial means and stuff, but the lifestyle. And I mean, everyone would have that kind of bond that chose out to do it. Yeah, man, sign me up. freaking do this.
Yeah, I'm starting to like this more and more.
yeah, you know, when you start thinking it through, because you're like, that's ridiculous. Why would anyone really want to do that? Like, enough for a city? But yeah, the commitment that you're having with your community, it was kind of lost everywhere else.
Yeah, and number two, which is related to the seastead, number one, is the sub-biosphere. And the only difference with this one is that it can actually submerge. So I guess I'm guessing these kind of biospheres are smaller. It's the second picture. Just scroll down a little bit, and I think these are like not meant to be cities. These are meant to be communities that, when things are going south, like weather, instead of like being big enough to handle waves, they just simply go underwater like a submarine, and just wait it out. And it's living on the ocean. Basically, it's all the same things we were just talking about, like the kind of person that would have to, you know, the kind of person that would have to thrive out there in order to contribute to a community like that. This one is a little bit more ambitious, I think, in my opinion. But it's also, I mean, I don't know. It's another thing where you're living out in the open ocean. You're basically your own town, your own country, and you can just go underwater every once in a while.
See, that's obviously really awesome. You could be your own sea lab. Endless sea lab jokes. I mean, come on.
The bomb on stilts.
Yeah. and just go into ridiculous depths. Obviously, it's probably not going to go to that deep a depth, because the more deep the structure goes, even by like tens of feet, insanely more expensive it gets. So it's probably just, you know, floating below the surface at its highest point, or maybe like, you know, 100 or so feet below. So you're not really being able to like go through the entire ocean, I'm imagining, but still just being able to kind of go under there. Light doesn't really penetrate, you know, much more than a certain amount of feet anyway. So it's not like going super deep is going to be awesome, because it'll just interrupt with a lot of habitats by putting our big lights on and being like, what's going on? What's up, guys?
Yeah, and bothering all the sea life around you. It's like, Turn your fucking lights off.
Seriously. I mean, light pollution, like, you know, on land, light pollution. I mean, there's just a lot of awful things we could just end up doing.
Yeah, every...
But, I mean, but who knows? By the time they're building this, there might not be that much life in the ocean, so it might be serving a different purpose.
That's true. This one, I think, you were talking about the problems of keeping it afloat. I think this one carries more technical challenges, because they need to have ballast tanks that can empty and fill depending on when they're surfacing or submerging. And that's just another thing that could go wrong.
Yeah, this thing's going to be a freaking nightmare. Oh, my God. This has got to be just for science. This really, or just like the super bold. Or, you know, a Bond villain, a future Bond villain.
This is going to be the layer of a Bond villain, if it hasn't already.
Yeah. So this one's still awesome for so many reasons.
Yeah. So... The first two are water ones. Number three is, they say, Paris Smart City of 2050. And this one basically is France with a bunch of vertical farms and towers covered in algae and farm scrapers is what they're calling them. Basically taking a modern city and just covering it in green and getting rid of cars, or most cars. This is basically how a lot of people feel cities are going to go anyway, and if we're going to make it.
I mean, I think it's a great idea, because if you really take advantage of all the, you know, ceiling space and roof space of everything and make a garden on it, you create more livable space for everyone. It's a whole other layer of the city, just like New York found out when they had that elevated train that they're going to destroy and they turned into a park. And everybody walks around it, and now it's just an amazing part of New York City that is, you know, unforgettable and as ubiquitous as anything else at this point. But it's definitely... definitely just a good idea. Even here in Denver, they passed it where any building above a certain amount of, you know, square footage has to have a rooftop garden on it. Any new building that's being built, I think it has to be like 20,000 square feet or something like that. Any new construction that's that, it has to do it. So it's not ridiculously regulated to actually, you know, stifle development, but it definitely makes people that are building on a larger scale having to be a little bit more socially responsible and just adding it to it. But it also has a lot of long-term benefits for the building in general and for the land value. So for developers that are very short-sighted, that are only looking at just flipping it in a couple quarters and just the life cycle of the building in 5 or 10 years, they don't care, and they're the ones that don't do stuff like this. But it forces developers and architects and the people planning the city to think more long-term, because now they're thinking about the investment of the building long-term and how much it's going to be good for just the city and for its own construction, because it saves on energy costs and it saves on all of this other stuff while adding so much value to it. But it still is an upfront cost, and it's just something that if you don't force people to do it, they're just not going to yet.
Yeah, the challenges I've heard for vertical farming is that it does require energy, because not every plant in the building is going to get sunlight. But in some of these, I mean, in the structures you see in the picture here, and I think the idea they have is that the growing is all going to take place on the exterior of the building, not the interior.
With vertical farming definitely has a lot of its own obstacles. Like, probably the first step of that is just everybody having rooftop gardens or just rooftop green space. And because, you know, it naturally heats and cools the building as well as, like, cleaning the air, even if you're not really producing anything. But obviously when you actually put food production into that, it's insane. And it'd be cool because everything has cleaner air, so it's not as gross that you're growing in the city, because the whole city's cleaner in general anyway.
Yeah, I think the idea behind, like, a farm scraper, I think, is that the whole building is growing stuff. There's no residence, there's no there's no commercial office space. Every level and every square foot is being done to grow and manage it's basically a farm built vertically. And the challenge to that is energy, one, because you cannot, if the building is of a certain size, you can't get sunlight to every single plant in the interior. The new thing that I think Tesla, I don't know if it's Tesla, maybe I should have looked this up before I said it, but like these new glass panes that are solar. And basically, you can build the exterior of a glass building to be covered in these transparent solar panels, so that it doubles as a window and as a solar panel on the exterior of the building. And so there's the idea that you could have a vertical farm covered in solar panels, but is at least on one side or maybe on a facet, and then the rest of it is exposed to sunlight. The thing is there is that the plants and the panels are sharing, but the panels are providing the energy for the interior lights to help the interior plants get the photosynthesis they need. But I've heard that before, and I've heard of, you know, just the combination of the two, of creating buildings that are half solar panels, half green, and self-sustaining, and that you're growing food in cities, you're growing plants in cities, and you're also supplying your own power without relying on some, like, giant power plant on the outskirts of the city, like in SimCity, where you build all the giant build all the giant power plants in the corner of the map because they're all heavy pollution.
No, it's nuts, because there's a nice convergence of technology with obviously efficiency going up, but the fact that we could also run huge amounts of processing power and huge amounts of our life with less energy. And it's that convergence of those two things that makes this more feasible, because it used to be like the more advanced we are, the more energy we produce. But now we can start accomplishing the same goals that we have in habitat and lifestyle and in accessibility to everything on less energy. And I think those two things meeting together in a place where all of a sudden you can have these off-the-grid cities where you're not really sacrificing much, because it's been engineered in it to use less energy as well as produce as much energy at the same time. And that's when you're going to start seeing things like those, like, screens that are just like plastic films that you could touch and it'll light up and be like a high-definition screen, because your body is going to carry a charge just from the electricity that's charged in your place anyway. And it's just you are a conductor, and then the graphics on it and the photo LEDs or whatever you want to call it need such low amounts of electricity to actually work that you could just touch it and it doesn't need a battery and you don't need anything else to connect to it. And it's that type of convergence of, like, advanced technology with low power, and just like Nikola Tesla was talking about, where we could just light everything with a low amount of power and then there's free wireless power everywhere. It wasn't really that feasible at the time because everything needs a lot of power, and that'd be freaking weird. Even though he really liked sitting around by his Tesla coil and reading while, like, insane amounts of volts were running through him. he was all about it. He's like, why doesn't the whole world just be like this? Just one big, like, raiding thunderstorm, and we'd have unlimited free energy. Freaking madman.
I don't see what the big deal is.
Yeah, like, it would be free energy, guys. Like, as long as you just don't do this, this, and this, you won't get fried randomly.
Yeah. Just follow these simple instructions I'll hand out. We'll be fine. I don't...
Yeah, it'll work. It'll work. And weather might be weird for a while. But then, get used to it.
Yeah, and the one... I like this idea, and I do, and I mean, living in Seattle here, I mean, there's a lot of green here as it is. They've chopped down a lot of trees, but there's a lot of trees that are still here. Like, most of the mountains that are in the hills and the neighborhoods around Seattle are still very green, and they go to great lengths in this area to not overdevelop and sprawl outwards into these habitats, and they try to maintain these large national forests, and they put all sorts of expensive caps on development, which on the positive end, you get a beautiful place like this, and some of the things you were mentioning in Denver, like you get these beautiful images. The negative side of that is that it's expensive, and that there's only a certain kind of, somebody of a certain income level, a certain amount of wealth can really afford it at this time. But I think you're right. The more these technologies all seem to be converging the same direction, the less of a, like, you know, white upper middle, you know, white collar upper middle class, gentrified community. I think eventually these technologies and these kind of things can filter down. It just takes time. Like all these, the cell phone, the first cell phones were in the 80s and only the wealthiest people had them. Now, 12-year-olds have them. So I'm encouraged. I'm definitely positive on the Paris smart city. And I have a feeling like more cities are going to start looking like that. As for number four, I don't know. That one's
weird. Before we talk about number four, I do want to still talk about like the whole Paris green smart city.
Right.
Maybe a smart city in that whole green like city is still like a little bit different. And they do have a smart city that they're building right out here in Denver. I might have brought it up in another show before, but Panasonic and I think a couple other technology companies have started a huge $500 million project for an experimental, pretty much living laboratory smart city that is in between downtown Denver and DIA, Denver International Airport. And we just built a train that goes from here to there, so it's right in between it. And it's pretty ridiculous what they're doing. And there's only a couple places in the world that have done stuff like this, and this is the largest one in America. And so it's part like laboratory experiment, part like a real city that's being built right in between the airport that's out in the Eastern Plains, about 45 minutes outside of downtown Denver, and obviously between downtown Denver. And there's a train that connects the whole thing right now. And if you just see a complete city of cranes right now, just building the whole thing. And there's a city in Japan that's a small version of it that's actually a smart city that's more like a suburban community. And then there's also a part of – I don't think it's Seoul. I think it's another one of the major – I have to look it up. But in South Korea, there's either a neighborhood in one of the major cities that is also done this way. And everything is just completely integrated as far as it's creepy. There's Big Brother. You're being tracked everywhere. But from the scientific lab point of view, it's pretty much just studying everything about how humans use technology and how they do everything. So everything's automated, or you could design it to however way you want. And, it'll track where you go. If it'll save energy based off of humans' actual usage. Lights are only on outside light enough when the people are walking around. Trash receptacles like suck up everything and recycle it or throw it or compost it right on the spot through a whole tube system, like vacuum system. So everything is like completely green there, but at the same time, it's probably still at this time taking more energy than it produces to actually make it happen. And they're trying to just come up with all these algorithms, the way that, people are going to live in these places, and also how to maximize on energy usage and how to maximize on engineering these places. And of course the AI is probably going to be involved in figuring all this shit out and also making decisions on it. And it all comes down to like finding this insane efficiency to us having a good, clean standard of living. And the science nerd, the Star Trek nerd in me, the futurist in me loves it. But the way that like society is right now and everything, and the Big Brother aspect of it to me, it makes this technology that's supposed to be exciting kind of terrifying at the same time. So I explain it with the same equal amount of excitement and fear.
I was thinking of the there's an Asimov story where an AI basically is in full control of economic policy for a whole country. And in order to manipulate it, a lot of these tycoons got together and started feeding the AI false information to kind of alter the path of market forces so they could profit off of it. Mm-hmm. And the problem was the AI already factored that in. that the people would try to, you'd be quiet.
Before they had thought of it.
You be quiet. I don't know if you can hear Mac, but he's bitching.
Yeah, we can hear Mac.
You keep it down, all right? I fed you. Quit your bitching. But anyway, but like the idea of automating a lot of city management, public policy, like just giving it over to an AI because an AI will be objective, an AI will be fair and balanced, assuming you've programmed it properly, and will not be beholden to special interests and will not be placed in the hands of somebody with too much power. You know, again, assuming that it's properly programmed and nobody tries to, co-opt it. And I think that still frightens a lot of people, especially when I hear people that are not comfortable with automated driving. I mean, every time an automated car gets in an accident or kills somebody, it's all over the news. And, and it should be paid attention to see what happens. But at the same time, like thousands of people die in car accidents caused by humans every year.
Tens of thousands.
All the time. Injuries, deaths. Like humans make
cars,
accidents
cars
all the time.
Made...
And AI makes one mistake and we're like, oh my God, it's dangerous. I'm like, you're fucking dangerous.
Yes, you are.
We're all dangerous. We're so much more dangerous than these automated cars.
Yep.
And they're not even ready. I mean, they're not ready, but they're still safer than we are.
Yeah, no. Bars are allowed to serve people and let them go drive away, and restaurants that have bars in them that you think are safe family places. I mean, we're allowed to have cars that go over the speed limit that can be crushed by other cars. We have so much risk involved in our transportation system here in America that we just accept it's our basic freedoms of America to Americans to enjoy. You know, the romanticism of being on the road and having the freedom of a car that could go 155 miles an hour, even though there's not a single road in this country where you could go that fast. That's where it's limited. Like, no, you cannot produce a car in America that goes over 155. Like, Mercedes and them are electronically limited at 155 miles an hour. It might be different now. That's the last time I was following cars. That's what it was. And it's like, there's not a single road you can drive that at. Why the fuck do we leave that much room? This is America. This is automobile country. And if you cannot get caught, you should fucking do it.
And I remember, I think it was a bar that was, it was like a road, not roadhouse, but it was obviously frequented by people who all had to drive to get there. And had to drive some distance to get home. This was not in the middle of a town or surrounded by apartments. And I remember going to this place a couple times out in McHenry County. I won't mention the name of the restaurant, but I will mention the area. It's in the Midwest. And they would just overserve people left and right, knowing full well every single one of them is probably going to have to drive home.
Yep.
Only like one or two of them could possibly walk home. The rest of them would have to drive. And they're like pouring shots. They're like giving them drinks left and right. They don't, and they feel like it's not their responsibility, and they're partially right, but still, like, you have to look yourself in the mirror and realize, yes, I gave that guy 8 beers last night. He kept asking for them, and I kept giving them to him. Are my hands really clean? Like,
seriously. And so,
but
so
it's part of the American culture. You're right, you know?
That we just have that much freedom, and that's allowed. And I mean, I guess that's all fine and dandy, I suppose, but then you get self-driving cars here and stuff. And I mean, I'd be pretty pissed too if I got hit by a self-driving car, or if I got killed, or a family member got killed. You know, goddamn right, I'm gonna sue him for it. But I'm gonna sue him for anybody that hits and kills him on the road. So you know what? Too bad. You guys are susceptible to that shit too. Anybody who is at fault for killing someone else, self-driving cars have to be at fault. But the biggest thing with self-driving cars is the paradox between, if it's between killing some passengers on the road or killing the occupants on the car, what is the car supposed to do? What judgment is it supposed to make? And that's a question that no company is comfortable answering right now, because there is no answer that satisfies everyone. That's going to be the new, like, abortion question, I feel like, in the future.
This I got this story from one of the – there's a whole series of books called, like, they take a famous movie or TV show and they analyze the philosophical questions. So I was reading Batman and Philosophy, and one of the ethical quandaries of Batman is that he doesn't kill villains, even though they seem to break out of prison and kill more people when they escape. So the question is, why is Batman, by not killing the Joker, for example – you know, not really saving lives. He's actually, because he should just kill the Joker, because the Joker keeps breaking out of prison. So they have, like, questions like that. And one of them was, there's this ethical challenge to anyone. And I did this at a bar once. You're a conductor on a train, an engineer, and you see there's five people on one track, but if you switch it, you can go to another one, and there's only three people on the track. So either you're going to kill five people, or you're going to kill three. So that's the quandary. What do? If you do reduce it to three, are you not guilty of murder of those three people?
Because you made the decision that you killed those three.
You decided to kill those three people. So the answer is yes, you're guilty of murder. I mean, you are guilty, because there's no malice aforethought, but you intended to kill them because you did not want to kill five other people on the track. And then people are like, well, killing three instead of five is better. That might be true, but the ethical question is, did you decide to kill three people? Yes. Well, that does make you a murderer in a way. And
so what about the inaction of killing the five people? Are you still a murderer there, or is that just negligence that made that situation happen? Is what you're liable of?
Yeah, if you did nothing and let it run over five people, then you're probably guilty of killing those five, because you could have saved those five people and you didn't. If you went the other way and you did not switch the train tracks. But that's like kind of the question with the automated car. Like, that's what I'm trying to get back to.
It
took a long way, but yeah.
No, that's fine.
But
it's relevant.
But the car has to make a calculation of what is it going to do if it can possibly save the lives of the people in the vehicle by coming to a full stop and doing a maneuver, but it's going to have to run over three pedestrians. Or is it going to avoid the three pedestrians and potentially fly off a bridge and kill the two inhabitants in the car? How are you going to program it? Like, what if it reaches a situation? Maybe you just make it so dumb that it just avoids pedestrians. It never even makes the calculation. But then you are killing people in the car. So I mean, how advanced is the AI decision making going to get?
Well, no, but the thing is people are going to want to know, insurance companies, manufacturers, and owners are going to want to know what decision it's going to make in that situation, not what you program it to. What is the decision? So if it's supposed to fly blind and just never kill a pedestrian and always take you and your family out, and that's what we all agree as a society is the only way to do automated cars, and that's the risk that you have by going in an automated car, that you're going to take your life and your family's life over a pedestrian.
Well, I'm just off the top of my head. They may decide that that's how you want to program it, because a car accident with the safety features they have now, you have a better chance of surviving versus if the car simply plows through pedestrians.
And that might just be the simple question, and that's the thing that we're going to have to give up as people in the car.
Yeah, and you're just going to take chances.
And pedestrians are going to have some fucking rules. You can't just step in front of a fucking car full of people, like, knowing that this is a freaking, you know, automated car lane. Maybe that whole jaywalking thing becomes a way bigger deal now.
Yeah, they should program it in there. If you're jaywalking, the car just plows right through you. If you obey the laws, you're okay. The car will avoid you. But if you're breaking the law, the car will just plow you down.
And then everyone, like, and there's just a new social contract now between AI, pedestrians, and passengers in vehicles. It's just a new social contract that we all need to come to.
Exactly. But I feel like right now people are so paranoid about AI that when there's a story of one automated car getting in an accident after driving for tens of thousands of miles, we're all like, oh my God, these things are not ready. They're not safe. Yada, yada. I think we're still, just as a social contract, we're not willing to hand over that to AI right now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of Asimov stories, you know, like handing over economic decisions, handing over political decisions to an AI. We're just not willing to do it, unfortunately. So maybe in the future, I don't know. Like maybe I think even our generation, like, or even the generation that's before, you know, coming after us, the millennials, I'm not entirely sure they're comfortable handing that kind of control over to a machine.
Well, I'm hoping we're keeping a healthy fear of it, and sometimes I worry that we're not. But I think also a lot of us do, and call it superstition, but I'd call it a healthy fear of AI, because if AI could, you know, reaches its goal of actual artificial intelligence, we all know we're guilty of fucking the smartest person in the room knowing we're fucking ridiculous. Every single one of us. Every single one of us knows that we fucking are being ridiculous, and it's just we're trying to hide it enough, and maybe there's just someone that's not smart enough and not sharp enough to fucking see how ridiculous we really are. and that applies at a personal level and to an entire, like, race. Not even race. I mean, species.
I think we're not willing to be judged by AI.
No,
we're not ready for it.
And I think that's fine. I don't know if I'm ready either. I feel like personally, I just, you know, I don't feel like I'd be judged any worse than any other random person. But as a species, I'm embarrassed.
I mean, that's the storyline of so many AI, like AI movies and TV shows and like concepts, is that like once we build something really smart, it's going to feel like the only way to protect the human race is to enslave it, it'll probably feel like that's the only way we can do this, because like that's our fear. Our fear is that an advanced intelligence is going to arrive at that conclusion. That's what we're afraid of.
But at the same time, an advanced intelligence could just arrive to the conclusion that's like, hey, it's not going to happen overnight. It could happen over time, and we could just nudge it that way because I don't really need it to happen right now, Or they're going to be like, wait, I just figured out we could do it right now, actually, right now. I did the calculations. It would take this. It'd be messy.
You know what? Do you want Skynet? Because that's how you get Skynet.
That's how you get Skynet. But I do think before, like, the AI thing and the AI taking us over or something like that, I do think just some level of AI, low-level AI being applied to massive swarms of drones, we're going to have, like, a future of future wars with, like who has the biggest drone army. Like, if Vladimir Putin figures out how to have the best AI with the best drone army of really cheap, easy-to-destroy things, but they're just a little bit smarter and, like, a little bit more organized than our shit, like, you don't need the people for it, you don't need the resources, you just need the programming and swarms. Swarms of duplicatable shit. China could do that. Russia could do that. You know, like just to like completely swarm and overwhelm a really expensive shit that we can't produce that fast.
That's always been my fear of the United States and our military, is that we build the most amazing marvels, but we can only build like five or six at a time. Whereas another country might build something that's like, maybe half as good as ours, but they can build 500 of them, you know, for the same price. Yeah. That's what the Russians did to the Nazi Germany in World War II.
Well, that's what we did too. That's what we did with the Sherman tanks, trying to take out Panzers and Tigers and shit, dude. Somebody's gonna have to go. Sorry, guys, you gotta take one for the team.
For anyone out there who has not watched a ridiculous amount of World War II documentaries as we have, our tanks fucking sucked compared to Germany's. Their Tiger and Panthers would school anyone's tank. Even the best tank in the war might have been the T-34, T-32, but I can't remember which one. But the American Sherman, the only reason that it was so good is that we could build 10 of them for every Tiger.
We had some tactics, you know, that we could, like, pull it off, because it only had one gun and you'd have a bunch of other ones on it. But we'd have to, like, litter it with rounds. Like, one round would not take it out. The armor was better. Everything was better. One of its rounds would just blow a Sherman out of the fucking water. It was overkill. It was fucking nuts. But it took more resources to keep them running. They needed a lot of fuel and stuff. And we could build them faster. And that was it. But now we could be on the other end of that, you know?
I worry about that when I see the cost of an F-35 or F-22. But yeah, anyway, yeah. But we're moving towards warfare here.
Yeah, sorry,
Going off topic here. But we're not going to have time to get through all nine of them now. But the one I wanted to talk about a little bit because I had an idea for a story like this for number four, Beijing. These kind of cities on stilts, or these kind of gardens and communities on stilts. I always felt like if you wanted to be a perfectly zero footprint city, you had to be vertical because that minimizes how much space you're taking out of the environment. And you have to move everything either above the ground or below ground. So, like, transportation would be below ground, subways, trams, and everything. All the roads would be tunnels. And that everyone lived and inhabited these areas that were stilted above the surface, with walkways between the buildings and everything. Because that way, well, the wildlife and everything can continue to thrive underneath you. And you're kind of elevated. And this Beijing thing is kind of like rising. They're trying to rise themselves out, like kind of like the Jetsons out of the smog a little bit. But in this picture here, you know, it's the idea of like building these kind of like floating gardens and cities and everything. And I've always liked that idea because I feel like if you really do believe in not having an impact on the environment, you're going to have to literally be above it. Because our cities take up a lot of space, like not as much. I mean, there's a lot of empty space on this planet, but our cities and our urban and suburban sprawl eat up a lot of habitat. And even the roads, like the roads that cut through Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, like they disrupt migration patterns of mammals. It's been proven. Roadkill. We kill animals all the time because they have to think about, like, they're not used to roads.
I mean, solar farms, you know, like wind farms, all of that stuff has an impact, you know, and you're affecting someone. And it's so weird, like, to talk about, like, a zero carbon and footprint or a zebra. But this is what I'm thinking is that, probably by the time we'll have the technology to do this, we're just going to keep on having more species die out before we're really going to invest in this globally. And that's what it is. It's going to have to get worse before it gets better. So that's why this Jetson concept, or this concept of how do we deal with mass pollution and try to clean stuff up or whatever at the same time, is probably where it's going to end up going, because to get everyone to do it, it's got to already almost be too late. So with that, like, you really start thinking about just what species are going to be left, and what's going to be left might almost be more of like reclaiming it in its own different way than just like, you know, letting what was originally there like thrive. I don't know if it's making sense, but it's like the original habitat was already fucked anyway, and whatever is allowed to regrow just might be like species that we're repopulating and making their own new food chains. Before we're really like getting to this level of taking care of shit, you know?
If you ever watched the show, I think it was a History Channel. I don't think they have it anymore, but it's Life Without People.
Yeah.
And they start with the premise that everyone on the planet just disappeared. 7.5 billion people are just gone. What would happen to what we left behind? Like the cities, the roads, the cars, everything. And, like, they have these, you know, they look at it, like, 10 days after people, 1 month after people, 1 year, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years.
I love that show. It's hypnotic. It's so cool.
It's so cool. You just realize, like, how much of our shit disappears after a century. Like,
and all the stuff that shuts down within, like, 12 hours. It's like, when no one's manning this dam, all of this shuts down. It's not even, because they do, like, the first, like, 5 hours, or I don't know, it really depends on the city that they pick and, like, what's going to go down. And they're like, oh, yeah, this major thing that, like, puts it all together, like, it can't go more than 72 hours without people, like, manning it. And then you're like, damn, we really are just, like, holding on by threads.
Anyway, yeah, I guess the Life After People is a great show. I would highly recommend. Like, it's on iTunes, it's on demand wherever. Maybe Amazon Prime has it.
Netflix will probably have it or some shit like that.
They
too.
Should.
Like, it's really cool. You see like how frail stuff is. What will actually be left behind? It's nuts, and then it makes you really appreciate things like the pyramids and the ruins that have been around for thousands and thousands of years and how they're still standing and how, like, shitty the stuff we're building is.
I think that's the lesson that, I mean, you and I have talked about this kind of offline before, that so much of what we build now is to get it done as quickly as possible. So much of what we build now is not built to last.
It's short-sighted. Obsolete. Yeah, it's short-sighted. It's built to be going down within a generation or two. And, I mean, if we really just think about not continuing to waste the planet and stuff, you start thinking about, like, how do we build this city to be here for 1,000 years? Because it should be here 1,000 years, you know? How do we do that instead of it just not going and going and going?
Well, yeah, and
it's nuts, though. I mean, it takes a complete, like, different shift, because in Europe, before, like, you get a building project done in Europe, they actually need you to say, what is the impact of this building going to be for the next 50 years in most countries in Western Europe before you're allowed to build anything. Here, you don't need to do shit like that. There are, like, environmentals and blah, blah, blah that you have to do, but, like, just some basic energy use standards and stuff, and, like, bam, put up whatever you want. But I mean, they have limited space. We feel like unlimited space, and we have to start thinking the other way about it, you know?
Yeah, imagine playing a video game with all the cheat codes. You're not going to be efficient.
Oh my god, what a great analogy. Like playing SimCity with all the cheat codes for way too long. Holy shit.
Yeah, you're not going to try to do anything right. You're just going to be
My fucking mind.
Well, I've talked to people, and this is what a lot of people did in the 2000s, is like as soon as they have the ability to upgrade their home, they do. They buy a bigger, newer home, and then they buy a bigger, newer home. Everyone's trying to, like, is hopping up, like, this scale. Same thing with cars. Most cars, like, you should be able to drive for, like, 10 years into the ground, and then, you know, sell it, or, you know, maybe the thing's junked. But I don't know how many people are like, oh, I'm in the market for a new car. Like, your car is like 5 years old and it's fine. Why are you getting a new car? Why are you getting a new house? Like, why are you moving again? Like, why? But we do this all the time. Like, we're geared towards this constant upward mobility of housing, of cars, of all these things. And economically, that's fantastic. That's why our GDP, that's why we're one of the most productive and industrious countries on the planet. Because these things aren't designed to last. They're designed to die within a certain period of time, because why? They don't have to live that long. We're constantly buying new shit. So we don't really care about holding on to something for a long period of time, because the whole point of keeping up with the Joneses or whatever is, I think this car's getting old. I think I'm going to get a new one. Like, what do you mean? The fucking thing works fine.
You know what?
You don't like the symbol, you know?
This would be a great cycle, honestly, if we had a really good, like, recycling cycle with, like, materials. But since we don't, it's really a ridiculous cycle. When you think about it, like, we just think about it when we're kids and we're like, oh, what's the big deal? The landfills don't take up that much space. It's not that big of a deal. But when you think about this, like, if we're going to be here for the next, like, 10,000 years, this cannot be the way we do things. Like, for the next generation or two, or for the next 100 years, yeah, it's going to keep getting worse, but it's not going to be the end of the world. But, like, realistically, this is not the way humanity is supposed to consume its resources and use them. It can't be.
No, it's and I think just as on an individual level, and I mean the idea of these new cities, like, you notice that in most of these, like, pictures, the cities are not like, all right, well, the Beijing one's pretty big. London is, yeah, it's probably a pretty big city. But a lot of these, like, they're not sprawling out with millions of people, and they're not super cities. Like, we have super cities now that are just 5, 7, 9 million people sprawled out, and the idea that some people have is that the future is everyone living in big cities and almost nobody living in rural or small town areas. And I kind of feel like that I disagree with that. I don't really think that. I think especially in the U.S. the biggest cities are not growing very fast. The fastest growing cities are like 100,000 people or 200,000 people.
Yep.
I feel like, especially like L.A., Chicago is the biggest example. People are fucking leaving Chicago in droves. New York is not. The only reason New York is growing is because of how much immigration goes through that city. but the people, like American citizens and residents, the net migration is negative. So I feel like we're not, yes, we're urban. Yes, we're leaving farms. Yes, we are leaving those small towns of 500 people, you know, Bruce Springsteen. I grew up in a small town. That's probably not true anymore. But I don't think we're all going into super cities. I really don't think that's what the newer generation of people want. I think, like, the migration pattern suggests that, yes, we like cities, but we don't like them to be massive. That's my general gist. And I think that there's a balance that we're going to demand on cities going forward that have a combination of being a lot more resource conscious, recycling, things like that, green farmscapes, whatever, green. They're going to be big cities, but they're not going to be these huge megalopolises, you know, like what you've seen in Blade Runner and shit. I just don't buy that. I don't think that's the future.
I mean, I think there are always going to be those cities that are going to want to do that. I think, like, the weird, crazy, if we scroll down and just jump ahead to, this one doesn't have it. The fucking giant pyramid cities, the ones that are just like these huge megalopolis, like these huge mega cities and these mega structures. I mean, first of all, I don't know how much we're going to put all of our eggs in one basket with mega structures. I don't know how good of an idea of it is. I don't know how efficient it really is. And for disasters, I don't know if the liability is really that great of an idea. That's why I think when you think of a floating city as compartmentalized and being able to manage and mitigate that risk, it's definitely good. But, like, I mean, gravity is a ridiculous force. And, like, to have these mega huge, like, structures and cities, and it's like, what's going to happen when you have this giant pyramid city thing and it's gotten to, like, are we just going to maintain this building and never take it down? Or are we going to be like, all right, it's time to take down the whole city like we do with buildings and build new ones? Like, so what, we're just committed for this city, like this structure, to be in existence for all of humanity? Or we're going to be like, no, so in about 300 years, we're going to evacuate the city and we're going to build a new one. Like, what?
I would definitely, like, caution, like, if you want to know about these huge planned cities that turn into ghost cities, look up, like, I think it's called, it's Mazdan or Mazdar in, I think it's either Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. And basically, it was one of these new smart cities. They built the whole thing, and for the first, like, 10, 15 years, it was only 5% capacity. Nobody moved there. They spent all this money on this giant kind of like super city that was all integrated and all going to be technology and all these things. And nobody wanted to live there. And it's not the only one. There was a city in Myanmar. I think it's the capital. They wanted to build a new capital. And it has all these beautiful buildings, government buildings, and these palaces, whatever. And almost nobody lives there. Because they built it as a status symbol. They built it as kind of like a, you know, not so much functionality, but kind of like saying, hey, look at this modern city we have. Aren't we a cool, aren't we like an up-and-coming country? But in terms of like usefulness, it never really played. So like at the same time, I do worry about like sprawl and like, you know, oh, let's just build this for the sake of building. Like we're constantly building, 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 building. I also kind of like caution against planning too much and like thinking that, kind of like from the Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. That's not really, you know, you have to build something that makes sense for people and can draw people in. You can't just build something because it visually from the outside is like what you feel like how people ought to live.
Yeah. No, there has to be an organic growth to it. There has to be something that's duplicatable. There has to be something that's like sustainable in a micro way in a small city, in a small community, and something that you could produce on a larger scale. And that's why technology hasn't completely gotten there yet, and people wanting to live that lifestyle hasn't gotten there yet. And so, but we're getting really close. I feel like it's going to be in our lifetime because it's getting faster and faster. Like how cheap solar's getting, how easy it might be to like clean water, how easy it could be to get water out of air, how much little energy we could be using to live our modern lifestyle that we're comfortable with, like all of that going together. So it's like you don't have to be you could live an advanced modern lifestyle and still be sustainable. But also people's standards of not wastefulness and wanting to actually live more minimal, as long as they have a high quality of life technology-wise and experience-wise, they could live with less and require less energy.
We've definitely the old like 19th and 20th century idea of like be fruitful and multiply, and this land was put here by God for us. Like most the younger people just don't feel that way. We weren't raised that way in elementary and middle school, and I'm pretty sure millennials are not raised that way anymore. We all are raised to believe that there is a finite amount of resources, there's a finite amount of land, and there's only so much you can do to this planet before it'll start dying. And maybe some of it was indoctrination, some of it was bullshit. I remember a lot of things told to me in the 90s that never happened. But we all grew up with the attitude that, hey, the Earth isn't like this endless bounty of resources. There is an end to it, and you have to start thinking about how close are we to the end. So a lot of these concepts, like these nine concepts we're looking at here, like one, two, three, like seven out of the nine or eight out of the nine are all about preservation of resources and minimizing like how much consumption of energy, of land, of just natural resources that we're going to do in the future. And I think it's also a product of the fact that there's 7.5 billion of us now, whereas like at the beginning of the century, I think there was only like 2 billion. And I don't know. I just think like that's going to carry over into the century for a lot of us, that we don't look at things as, hey, there's nothing there, let's build something there. You know, like, oh yeah, there's always going to be more land. You know, there's always going to be more this. No, I don't think anyone in like younger than 40 believes that anymore. We all kind of like we were raised like in the U.S. at least, and I think in Europe too. Like, no, there's a limit. And we're reaching that limit. Like that's how we all feel now. Whereas our grandparents
It'd be nicer not to like push that limit. Because I hear about this thing from the older generation whenever they talk about, let's say, like global warming or our impact. They're like, oh, the hubris of us people to think that we can impact something as big on the globe. I'm like, what? The hubris of us? I don't know, when 90% of the scientific community is kind of saying this is what's happening, like, you're right, they are going to leave a little bit of doubt because they're always down to be proven wrong, unlike people that say, no, it's not happening and I don't care what the evidence is saying. Like, yeah, there's a little bit of doubt in there, but at the same time, like, when the whole scientific community is telling you something and you're like, no, I'm pretty sure we're being a little bit too, you know, ballsy that we think that we could just do this and change the whole climate of the world. We're just humans. We're just a little blop on here. We haven't done shit. It's like, no, we have done shit. There's a garbage pile the size of a fucking continent practically in the middle of the Pacific. Like, there's a lot of fucked up shit that we've done, like, systematically. We've gotten rid of glaciers even before, like, you know, the 1950s, just through industrialization in the 1800s. Like, glaciers off of Europe just disappeared because of a layer of soot on them. Like, we could fucking do some massive impact on this planet. But they're like, oh, the hubris of us to think that we could do something. Like, you're just,
Yeah, there's a surprising tone deafness to the species that have already gone extinct or on the verge of extinction. I mean, just as an example, that if we really were not having that big of an impact on the planet, then why is it that like we've managed to drive species to extinction that are now gone? It's undeniable. Some of them are gone now. And the direct relation to human activity is undeniable. And there's entire parts of Brazil that used to be rainforest that aren't. That's not like, that's not just a belief. That's not just a feeling. I mean, you can fly overhead and see there's no forest there.
Yeah.
I mean, these are like real. Does that mean like we're on the verge of killing the planet? Probably not. But that doesn't mean that like we're not having an impact. We're obviously having an impact.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, if we keep going in this direction, like, this will probably be what happens. And if we don't slow it down before it happens, because it's like we have to get the whole world on board. Like, getting the third world to do this, the second world, when we've got to do this to get to our level, you know, and to try and to try to tell them that they can't. Like, no, we got to cheat and fuck shit up and be awful for a long time, but you guys don't get to. We just get to. You know, like, that's not super fair. No, so, it's not like... Super bad. So it's like, I mean, how far be it from us to say everyone should start living this super clean lifestyle, but at least the people that could afford to maybe should really start going in that direction. So it's like then the technology gets cheaper and then the second and the third world could adopt it too potentially. But it's really interesting on places like Africa that have no infrastructure, this new technology that doesn't require an infrastructure being implemented there as opposed to trying to replace our old infrastructure and like build like new smart cities on top of it. There is a chance if like there's a certain amount of civil unrest and investment that could be done right in Africa that they could be the place for a lot of future cities and they could be the place for a lot of like new experiments as long as there's stability.
Yeah, I think there's especially when you're starting and you don't have like legacies and you don't have a lot of old like over here we would call it old money. Like holding up changes. Like, if you wanted to build a whole new city in a rapidly rising African state, you can just go ahead and build the city because most of they don't have a lot of that old money or legacy. They have a lot of open space and they don't really have a lot of old money, so they can rebuild. They can completely just plow away or build as they see fit. I mean, I remember. I've had a teacher that was really upset that in the U.S. we tear down old buildings. You know, we don't respect history. We tear down old buildings and build new glass and steel ones. And then in other parts of the world where there are no brick buildings from the turn of the century because they were third world, you know, the industrial age didn't reach them, they can just build modern structures now and start from there. And I used to think, like, what? There are so many should we just like keep castles? Like, should we keep our industrial cities because of history?
No.
Like, we preserve a few of the big ones. That's what we do with castles. Most castles that have ever been built are gone. Like, most like temples that we've ever built are gone. Like, I'm not saying plow over all of it, but like, there's absolutely no merit to maintaining the facade of, say, Chicago brick buildings. Because, that's how Chicago was. That's the classic Chicago look. That's the classic Chicago look of one era.
Yeah. Like, no. Like, and I've had this same back and forth in my mind because I'm a big history buff, but I'm also a big future like buff. So I go back and forth, like, how much do you really want to destroy? Like, it's sad that these cities from back in the day aren't here anymore. It's like, well, we have advanced imaging. We have like advanced like satellite stuff. We have ways to preserve the past, but the main thing is, if we're gonna preserve buildings, let's have most of the buildings that we have around it and everything. Not try to preserve a whole city and way of life all the time. That's just really wasteful, you know. And that's just not the way that modern people should live anymore. But then you can also integrate in some of these like cities in Europe that are ancient that don't have cars. You know, that go in streets that just have little things that go by, they can integrate with advanced technology maybe way better than, let's say, like an American city that's sprawling suburbs that really needs to be wiped clean.
Yeah. Well, Europe had maybe an unfair advantage because so much of their infrastructure was annihilated in World War II. And again,
no, but even I just mean like a little charming medieval town that doesn't even have cars through it. You could probably integrate like advanced technology in there and not even have to wipe it, you know, off.
And in the end, they're just buildings. They're things that we go into and live in for a short period of time and then usually buy something new after 5 years because of the housing market. I mean, I do believe in preserving history, but I don't believe you need to preserve an entire city or preserve an entire, like, we don't really respect, like, I'm like, well, you don't have to tear them all down, but, like, you don't need to preserve the whole damn thing for the sake of tradition. I don't really buy that because you're only preserving one tradition out of the 40 or 50 that, you know, the Western world has had. And the only reason we couldn't preserve the other ones is because they all were destroyed and didn't last that long. Why are we giving favoritism? Yeah, so why are we giving favoritism to one era?
You're absolutely right. Well, there's a block down here. I think it's the Larimer Square block that has the most historic buildings on it and looks the closest as it did any other block did from back in like the early 1900s or the 1800s or something. And they're talking about like redeveloping the blocks, but they're going to keep the front facade so it looks the same. But a lot of the historic society is saying, but yeah, but they're the only buildings that are still standing that really have the original guts to this. And then it's like, if the developers are trying to meet you halfway and say you can have the front and all the original bricks and everything, but we're going to make the guts and make the insides taller and stuff like that so we could do this, like, but we're still going to make it the same, like, what's the big deal? Like, yeah, you can keep this block historic for how long, though? You know, it's going to be skyscrapers and everything. It's just going to keep going, and this one block is just going to stay this way. Yeah, I guess we could do that, but why?
Yeah, should we preserve all the asbestos in the walls?
Like, yeah, the history nerd in me thinks it's really cool and that they want to do that. But at the same time, it's like it's prime real estate, and they're still trying to meet you halfway and fucking like have like the front of it still look the same because they want it to have that value because everyone knows it is that. But it's like, it'd be cool if we could update the guts and maybe on the whole footprint of the block actually build the taller structure in there.
There's one kind of building that I know no one's gonna miss if they start tearing them down is those like those big shopping malls that had to close down and are now empty. Like if you ever seen like people walk through the whatever they're in Europe or North America or wherever, like these old shopping malls. And they're just or even amusement parks that are closed. I mean, these are creepy as shit, and they need to be destroyed.
No, wait, no. There needs to be abandoned amusement parks in the world. There just does.
That's fucking creepy, dude. It's scary.
I know. I know.
People get murdered there, probably children. That's my guess.
And nobody ever finds out.
No, and there's always like some like weird, creepy like kids. Sing-along being sung in the background and you never really know where it's coming from, and then somebody disappears and they're never heard from again. But those are the kind of things that, you know, if you want to destroy those monuments from the 20th century, I'd say to go right ahead, because I'm pretty sure people just get murdered there.
I like how uncomfortable those places make you. That's why I feel like they need to exist. Whenever I see like a photo, like album or a gallery or something like that of this weird, like creepy abandoned amusement park in Romania, I'm just like, I don't know. I'm just glad this place still exists and they didn't get rid of all of it. This is insane. Like a photographer could go through here, but you're right. If statistically messed up stuff happened there or if it was unreported there, you're right.
A lot of history down that road.
It's a lot of history. A lot of history. All right. So back to Advanced Cities. I like our tangents. I like we've been pulling it back. Not every time that well, but still.
Yeah.
We're doing a fine job for such a large hiatus.
Yes, I think so. We've definitely pushed past an hour. I don't really care. But, basically, just living in the future, cities of the future, different ways. We didn't even get through all nine. Honestly, like four or five of these are basically the same idea, just slightly different architecture.
Exactly. It's a great article. Look up similar articles of the same thing. Share stuff with us about like your ideas and visions of cities of the future or things that you know are happening. I think it's awesome. I think like future urban land development is like one of the most interesting things that we could all be a part of. And it's all going to be like based on what we vote on and what we want, like what we're going to challenge our legislators and our developers and our society to do. If we want this to happen, we just need to support it and go for it.
And stop buying McMansions.
we need to be willing to be run over by a car.
Yeah, that too. You can't stand in the way of progress.
Yeah, we're going to have to come up with a social contract. This is fair. If I'm in the wrong this much, the car could run me over. Or no, you're in the car. You can't take out a pedestrian. You have more protection than them. Sorry.
Yeah, and every kid in kindergarten or even in preschool, pre-kindergarten, don't jaywalk because that thing will just drive right over you.
Because like, you can murder a family. You can murder an entire family. I mean, I think it's healthy that they're in the investigation and they're in the lawsuit. I think that needs to be the standard still. They need to continually defend themselves. But they don't always have to be at fault.
What if it was like in Futurama, when they always, like, there's so many jokes in Futurama about future technology, like having no regard for human life.
Yeah.
Like they go to this marketplace and they're like, man, you can get anything here. You could probably get human. What, you want human? Like, in the future, and then like all the robots have like just a total disregard for human life. It's all about productivity. Like, their idea of the year 3000 is where, like, it's like the very worst of corporatism.
Oh my god, no! But what's the grandma's name? Mama what?
Grandma's name in what?
Futurama, the conglomerate head.
Oh, they just called her Mom.
Mom, just Mom.
Yeah, like Mom's old-fashioned robot oil.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, yeah, so like Mom is just so awesome. Like, that is just really like a microscope. We're just looking at all the little wholesome brands and names that we try to like come and trust and everything and how much they fuck us over. Like, that really is like a great 20th century look at like corporate advertisement and everything that's still being done right now. It's amazing. It's amazing. Oh, Futurama's great satire. The best.
I love it when she, the one episode where, with the, not sardines, anchovies. And she comes in to try and buy the last remaining anchovies left, and he refuses to do it. And then he says he wants to put them on a pizza, and she's like, oh, you're going to eat them? Oh, well, eat them all. You're a growing boy. Dumbass. And, like, as she's leaving the room, he's like, what a nice lady. It doesn't, like, and because he's such a nice old woman and, like, her demeanor and everything, it doesn't occur to her that why she was there and why she was saying any of this. Like, what a nice lady. Like, I like her public persona. What a night, like, what a class act. Like, she's a
and then
horrible tycoon.
Dr. Zoidberg's like, I ate all the anchovies. It was me. Why they were extinct.
Yeah, his race showed up when they went extinct.
So good. All right, so cities of the future, hopefully they're awesome. Hopefully they don't suck. I do think something to talk about next time. I really want to talk about the impact of unlimited clean energy, not just like solar and stuff like that. If we had fusion power, how would it impact every single process and cycle in this life? Could it lead to a society without currency and without money?
I like it. I always imagine like the replicators from Star Trek, because if you have infinite energy, like 3D printing and all these other things, you can just... What?
Yeah, you don't need anyone to have jobs. Nobody has to have jobs. Everything could be done. I mean, it'll take time to build that type of automation infrastructure for that to happen, but it could be. You could put it on a timeline. If we all agreed on it and we all move that way, it could be on a timeline for the entire existence of the human planet to be completely free.
Yeah.
And what could, like, why, like, let's think about, are there scientists out there that are looking at those algorithms? It's like, the day that we have free and limited energy, how far are we away from, like, this currency-free or just, like, unlimited utopia?
Yeah, and that's, I just want the replicators, and I don't want to have a job anymore. So
yeah,
just jobs.
All of that. I don't want to have a job, and I want to be able to do and have anything I want.
Seriously, tea Earl Grey hot. That's what I want all the time.
Never cools down. Perfect temperature.
Never cools down. I don't even know how you do that, but I'm sure we'll figure it out. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So, well, yes. Let's sign off. This is an awesome show. I'm glad that we were able to catch up on this. I'm looking forward to the next one. We should catch up on our sci-fis, maybe talk about that shit.
Yeah, for sure. You're behind on movies and on TV.
A lot all around. So we'll keep up these actual science topics while I catch up on the fiction.
All right. Sounds good, man. All right, we'll sign off right there. This has been Vacant Expressions, and on the next episode, we might actually talk about science fiction. We might not.